What do foam fingers, wobbly tables, and Michael Bay's Pain and Gain have in common?
You'll find out all about them on Now Hang On a Second.
Welcome, and thank you for joining us for this installment of Now Hang On a Second. I'm Nalexis Signahi. With me, as always, is co-anchor Christopher Killarney.
Thanks, Nalexis. Now, Hang On a Second is our sampling of the best programming from across our family of public radio stations. These are the stories so interesting, so weird, so unexpected that they make you sit back in your seat and say, now, hang on a second.
To start off our time, we turn to the intersection of pop culture and the economy for a segment we like to call Pop Economy. Julessa Avignon filed this report. It was the shriek heard round the world. When pop star Miley Cyrus threw caution and her clothes to the wind during her performance at the 2013 MTV Video Music Awards, she got just about everybody talking. From her orthopedic-looking white creeper shoes to her tongue-out-of-cheek antics, pretty much all Twitter could muster was talk of Miley's loss of control. By the time Miley simulated sensual acts with a white foam finger with bright red nails, everyone seemed to agree that she had gone too far. Everyone, that is, except Herb Hayflick of Hayflick Foam Hands in Fulton, Missouri.
Oh yeah, I was pleased as pickle punch to see one of our hands at the center of this.
You see, Hayflick Foam Hands is the number one maker of off-brand or derivative foam hands.
Old Steve Kemlaw, he still owns the patent on the classic foam hand. You know the one that looks like you're making a number one with your hand, like you see at sports games? That's all Kemlaw. Our derivative hands are a more creative option.
Hayflick Foam Hands has been in business since 1986, when the Hayflick family farm in Fulton was forced out of business by drought and a cessation of egg-specific farm subsidies.
Everyone knows that Reagan hated eggs. He had a real vendetta. That son of a bitch.
Faced with a family to feed and an excess of the foam padding used in egg transport, Herb turned to nearby Missouri Southern University for inspiration.
It started with the classic design, you know, Go Tigers and all that. Then we got our first cease and desist order from old Kemlaw, so we had to think outside the finger, so to speak. Kemlaw and Reagan could go to hell.
After rounds of trial and error in making other foam-based sports fan products.
Foam church fans were a bust, too flimsy. Foam seat covers were fine, but the vinyl covers market is all sewed up.
So Herb went back to the finger idea, but with a twist.
Well, I thought to myself, when I'm at Mizzou games, I'm rarely thinking, we're number one. I'm usually just, ah, boo, go home, Jayhawks.
That would be the Kansas State Jayhawks, Mizzou's traditional rival.
So we took that anger and just made it foam. So we got Reagan, Kemlaw, and the Jayhawks can all go to hell.
And so Hayflick Foam Hands had its first hit on its hands with the bird, a middle finger salute to the Kansas Jayhawks.
The missus found it a bit fresh, but the kids loved it.
And so, the derivative foam hand market was born.
Now, we've got the bird, the fist pump, which is a raised fist. They love it at those UFC fights. The AOK, that's a big hit at the state fair since it's all happy and good times. And, of course, live long and prosper!
That's right. Hayflick foam fingers have found their way into and onto the hands of that ever-attractive consumer group. Nerds. All one need to visit is the floor of Omnicon Comics and Culture Convention in Rancho Cucamonga, California, to see proof of this.
Oh, the Vulcan salute hands are the best.
They really went the extra mile, since it says live long and prosper on the palm side, and then you can flip it over and it says peace and long life on the back of the hand.
As that is the traditional response. I'm sure when scripting the iconic phrase in the classic episode, Amok Time, Theodore Sturgeon did not intend people to repeat each other.
Live long and prosper. Live long and prosper. No, you live long and prosper.
I mean, how silly does that sound? Both Trekker compatriots stride away,
heading to a panel where a professor of physics from local Rancho Cucamonga Community College will discuss Neil deGrasse Tyson's views of the Star Trek episode Mirror, Mirror. That's where the crew meets their brutal, bizarro selves.
My son-in-law came up with the indoor kid one, of course.
So how does Herb feel about not only revolutionizing the foam hand game, but also integrating into the trappings of American sports culture, a community largely segregated from those traditions?
It's nice. I mean, if it involves a hand, we can probably make it.
With 60 employees and a growing market, Herb sees the Miley as their next big hit.
We can't keep the hand with nails. We call the acrylic in stock. I don't know what that girl is going through, but it is great for business.
And with that, Herb sauntered off towards one of the three foam presses at his workspace, a man confident that his work has a point. Julessa Avignon, reporting from Fulton, Missouri.
For our culture beat, we take a look at an alcoholic trend just reaching the country of Slovakia.
Yes, Alexis. Reporter Hubert Rock Solman decided to find out how Red Bulls and vodka have made it over in Slovakia. Just a warning to sensitive listeners, we do acknowledge the existence of sex.
It's a Saturday night. You've had a long week and you're feeling a little sleepy. You go to your bartender and ask for something to wake you up. He or she won't even think twice. You'll get a Red Bull and vodka. A huge trend in the early aughts, Red Bull and vodka is a drink made with the Red Bull energy drink and the liquor vodka, known by many other names such as Bolka, Eye Opener, Imranos, RBV, Red Eyes, Heart Attack, Lawn Chair, Raging Bull, Cannonball Run, The Walkies, It's Damn Fine to Meet You, and Horny Horny Long Time. The popularity of the drink has faded a bit in the U.S., but it's not forgotten, especially among the younger generation.
Probably have three or four on a Friday night, you know. Pick up a girl, do it right.
Brock Tierney, a college senior at the University of Kansas, says RBV is part of his normal routine.
Pre-party at six or so, pound one, then do a couple shots, then head down to Mickey's where I get one or two more. Then by 10, we're down to Mahoney's, and I have at least one more. And then I'm good till Electric Blue closes at 4 a.m., you know? Hit up Riedel Castle on the way home, and that's a night.
According to the U.S. Bargoers Association, Red Bull and vodka is just behind Irish car bombs and slutty sea breezes as the third most popular drink in the United States. But Dr. Heather Miles, a resident physician at Los Angeles Villaraigosa Memorial Hospital, has a different take.
When you put the body through a conflicting body chemistry, it gets very confusing. Red Bull shoots you up while vodka pulls you down. It's like crying and laughing at the same time. Or drinking while urinating, or being put in one of those medieval stretching machines. You're moving in two directions at once, and the heart attack nickname is appropriate.
But that hasn't stopped the drink from not only getting popular here, but moving across the sea. In Slovakia, the Red Bull energy drink reached its shores a couple years ago, and its sales have been strongest on college campuses and retirement homes. Red Bull declined to comment for this story, saying they do not condone or endorse combining their beverage with any other liquid, including liquor. Sladka Trudevev is a vodka manufacturer in Slovakia. Its dirty brown exterior reveals a pristine white linoleum-covered interior where vodka and whiskey is serious business. Piotr, a stout, bespectacled man in a poor-fitting brown suit, is not a fan.
I have never heard of anyone drinking vodka with Red Bull. Why would you do that? Red Bull is way up, vodka is way down. You would die, right?
Over at Here's to America, a popular bar in downtown Bratislava, a local bartender, Leona, shares her experience.
I have heard of drink, but it's stupid, no? One guy told me he was up for 9 hours straight just reading books. We call it a DSE in English.
DSE stands for Dumbest Shit Ever.
We call it Dumbest Shit Ever because it's Dumbest Shit Ever.
Ian and Drew, two Londoners having their holiday in Bratislava, were enjoying their drinks at their table.
We love the strength so much. Good job, America.
I'll be up to 6 a.m. with this here concoction.
Oi.
But to the locals here in Bratislava, it's not that popular. Blut and Hurt, two young men wearing barely buttoned collared shirts and emitting a bouquet of cologne scents, shared their opinion of the popular American drink, which in local slang is called Ugnashya Iglornivria.
I don't drink Ugno. It's dumb. Why do I want to have a heart attack?
If you want to be gross, you don't want to sound like you're on the fast four.
Like you're...
Oh, it's like Police Academy.
Yeah, I like Michael Winslow.
He's the Police Academy guy. That guy in Police Academy.
So while Red Bull and vodka isn't too popular in Slovakia, there are some things we can all agree on. At least in Bratislava, the only thing they need to stay awake is a good tune. I'm Hubert Rock-Salman, reporting from Bratislava, Slovakia.
I'll grab it. So I was at an In-N-Out Burger, a popular hamburger restaurant in Southern California.
Okay.
And I took a seat, you know, at a table. I had my tray and I rested my arms, you know, on the table. And it did something I'm sure everyone has had happen to them.
What's that?
It wobbled.
Whoa.
It wobbled?
It was all wobbly.
Oh, your drink might spill over.
Oh, yeah, I've had that happen before.
Right? And I was wondering, how does this happen?
What do you mean?
I mean, someone doesn't sneak into In-N-Out Burger in the middle of the night with a pair of pliers and loosens, loosens the screws on one table.
That might happen in a high school cafeteria.
Right, but not everywhere.
Everywhere?
Yeah, everywhere.
Well, I don't know. I guess I'd say that in a given month.
This is Bernard. He is in charge of maintenance for our building here in downtown Los Angeles.
I probably get 1 to 2 calls per month.
Per month?
Yeah.
You get 1 to 2 calls per month about desks being wobbly?
Yeah. Does that sound like a lot?
It sounds grossly inefficient.
It's easy to fix. I just take my pliers and rip, 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 rip.
I have to agree with you, Christomofer. That seems like a lot of tables unscrewing themselves.
So I got to thinking. Now, hang on a second. Why is this screw loose? Which is why I'm making it my topic for this week's Boom Goes the Science. I decided to call a table manufacturer, a furniture construction company of sorts.
You mean like Ethan Allen or Thomasville? Lazy Boy.
IKEA.
I'm Rebecca Murtaugh, customer care regional manager for IKEA.
So, you know why I'm here, right?
You want to know about screws? You're the screw guy, right? So...
Well, don't say it like that.
Well, I had the research guys do some data crunching for us.
I do love data.
And it looks like in 2009, we had 7,498 pieces returned because, quote, screws came loose, end quote.
Wow, that's a lot of unscrewing.
Sure is. Now, we should differentiate here because in that same year, for nail-related returns, we had 4.
Did you say 4?
I did.
That's astounding. That's a huge gap. So what's the difference?
Well, a nail is usually forced into something by a hammer or some other object. There's very little friction around that object, so returns are usually some kind of factory malfunction. But the thing about screws is their shape.
She's talking about the ridges.
Exactly.
See, the ridges on a screw or a lug nut or anything of that nature allow those pieces to be assembled and tightened much easier by a consumer. The average adult person can do about 70 to 80% of the effort needed to put that screw in. You do usually end up needing some sort of tool to finish it up, but, you know, a nail, you'll have to use brute force.
Now, Alexis, I'm not a brute force kind of guy. So this all made sense to me, but here's the kicker.
I mean, the thing is, just as easily as screws go on, they can come off.
So why is that? Why do screws just come undone?
Well, that's the thing. They don't. While we processed the majority of these returns, the product itself wasn't faulty. Either the customer didn't initially secure the screw or lug nut properly in assembly, or later in adjusting, they didn't do it enough, or they did it too much.
As simple as that?
As simple as that.
But that doesn't explain...
Right, the table. If I'm sitting at a table that I know has not been tampered with in any way, and it's wobbly, a screw has come loose all on its own?
I say it's impossible.
Something made it come loose.
And there was the key. Bernard didn't say someone, he said something.
What, like a force of nature?
You're close.
Hi, I'm Dr. Bill Preliak, physicist in residence at the Fresno Space Observatory, and I just had some coffee.
Dr. Bill Preliak runs the Fresno Space Observatory and gave me a great physics lesson.
Think of it like this. The Earth is rotating, spinning around the Sun every 24 hours. The Sun is moving relative to us. We are moving relative to it. While this rotation is happening, like clothes in a washing machine, gravity is pulling us and everything inward, which is why we don't shoot off into space. So let's zoom in on this screw, and whatever it's screwed into. All we need is a tiny bit of anything to get in the way of those screw ridges to weaken that bond ever so slightly. We have whooshing, rotating, gravity pulling, natural decay of material, which means...
means my table gets all wobbly.
Means your table is going to shake.
Okay, so if that's true, why isn't every single table...
Why aren't there screws flying all over the place?
Well, yeah.
Every single screw in the world will, one day, some decades from now, come loose a little bit. But the majority of screws will stay in place long past the asteroid destroys us in 2036.
Oh, when you put it that way.
So, wait, where does that leave us?
Well, back to the table. Excuse me, ma'am?
Yes, sir?
That table over there is a little wobbly. Do you have...
Here's some napkins. Just shove it under the leg.
Oh, yeah. Duh.
In his ongoing series, film critic Donovan Schwartzbaum explores films he discovers the way many of our listeners do, by throwing up his hands and asking the new Netflix selection assistant, Max, what he should watch. This installment is 2013's Pain and Gain.
Being a personal trainer is just that, personal. I'm not going to lie, when a client doesn't feel the same way, it hurts.
Pain and Gain is director Michael Bay's triumphant return to the intentional comedies of his early ascendant career. Far from the bloated, hacky wink at the audience, so they know you know the writing is awful, fare he's known for as of late.
Are you Samuel James Witwicky, descendant of Archibald Witwicky?
Yeah?
My name is Optimus Prime.
Pain and Gain reminds the audience that Michael Bay is a filmmaker with a message, even if that message is GNC live well. Loosely following the exploits of the Sun Jim Gang in sun-soaked 1990s Miami, Pain and Gain examines the path that would turn three bodybuilders into kidnapping torturers. While some might shudder at the lighthearted glee that stars Mark Wahlberg, Dwayne The Rock Johnson, and Anthony Mackie take in savaging and understated but hilarious Tony Shalhoub, Bay is begging the audience to examine their own lust for viewing such brutality.
Don't be a don'ter. Do be a doer. I had a wife, two beautiful daughters, a perfect partner. Thank God I left her. Now I'm with seven honeys of which I can choose from.
The real revelation of Pain and Gain is Bay's subtle commentary on masculinity in a modern America. Every time Bay presents an oiled male torso, a pair of oversized plastine breasts, or a jump cut to a champagne-drenched pool party, Bay's asking, nay, demanding, that we confront the whey protein-soaked, bling-bling-obsessed young men that populate the American landscape. While Bay missteps in his inclusion of a love story between Mackie and Rebel Wilson's Robin Peck, a distraction from the real love story between men and their free weights. This is one viewing experience from which I felt no pain, with great gain. Donovan Schwartzbaum, for now, hang on a second.
Alexis, are you making a duck out of paper?
Well, Christomofer, I've used the ancient Japanese art of origami to create a perfect recreation of an u'on bato, or wombat.
The Australian marsupial?
One and the same. I first encountered this Spartan noble art while on assignment in the South Kuril Islands, reporting on the long simmering tensions between Russia and Japan over the so-called Northern Territories. As I wound my way through rural fishing villages, thick with tension over rights to fish and waters surrounding the contested archipelago, I found the locals taking solace in the sacred practice of artful paper folding.
Wow. Wow.
Yes, Christemofer. Wow, indeed. This week I was fortunate enough to sit down for a discussion about developments in the papercraft world with the best-selling author of works on the practices of origami.
That's a basic Starbucks. Great for Hershey Kisses, or Werther's Originals, Necco Wafers even. Really any flat candy.
Oh, I'm Evan Jacob Peters, author and editor of The Klutz Guide to Origami.
Evan, I have to say it's a great honor to have you here in the studio discussing this dignified craft.
Well, Nalexis, it's a real pleasure to be here. Anytime I'm able to spread the word about how fun, easy, and accessible origami is, well, that's a good time for me.
Well, now, is accessible really the right word? Your book goes into great lengths to break apart what is essentially a pseudo-religious art.
Oh, anyone can do origami. It's great for kids.
Speaking of the young, I do see that you've geared your book away from some of the more radical origami arts. Tanisho Munfume's single-sheet sculpture of a humpback whale sitting atop a fisherman's spear recently displayed at MoMA comes to mind, in favor of more simplistic creations.
We have some really complex designs in the book, like this leaping frog. See, it leaps.
It does indeed leap. Now, Evan, I do not mean to be imposing myself on you.
Not to worry.
But I'd love feedback on one of my own creations.
Is that...
It's a 1-200 scale model of a Russian gulag, as described in Alexander Solzhenitsyn's One Day in the Life of Ivan Denisovich.
Are those...
tiny prisoners cleaning the guardhouse? Yes. I found the paper typically used in architectural printing to afford me the scale I wanted without forcing me to use too many sheets.
How many sheets did you use in this?
Six.
Six?
Six.
And no glue or cutting? Even for the,
tiny spoon and Comrade Sukhov's boot? No. It's all part of the same sheet of paper. Ironic for a timeless literary symbol for individuality, no?
Well, I can safely say this is a totally unique creation.
I've brought along the design plan. I thought there might be room in the next edition of the Klutz Guide.
Alexis, how did Evan respond to your offer?
We had a really in-depth discussion about the market for Klutz books and why a novel about life in a Siberian prison camp, Nobel Prize winner though it may be, would likely alienate some of their core 5-to-8-year-old readership.
Well, his loss is our gain, as your creation now sits with us here in studio.
Thank you, Christemofer. And to our listeners, thank you for joining us for this edition of Now Hang On a Second. As always, I'm Nalexis Signahi.
And I'm Christemofer Killarney. We want to thank our sound engineer, Sasha Tart.
Our producer, Carrie Callahan.
Our staff librarian, Jonathan Enriquez Hoffman.
And our interns, Carla Janice Hoyt and Amanda Craig.
And our music supervisor, Dan Wessels. Thanks.